Right, thanks to the worship team and to Ben for doing the reading as well. We are in our Hebrew series where we've been following through we've sort of seen it as a sermon that this preacher is calling to a group of Jewish Christians living in a time of persecution. And so that's where we're headed today. Again, do you know by nature we're harder on those that we love than those that we're indifferent to? A teacher is going to be harder on their favorite student because they love them and they want them to succeed. And so they're going to push them harder than they may other students that don't have their potential. A coach might be harder on the star player, expecting them to be at every practice early and leave every practice late. A parent might be harder on their own child compared to the child of a neighbor. This is because when we love someone, we're invested in that person. We actually care what happens to that person. And so we tend to be harder on those we love because we long for them to have joy and success and peace in life. Well, as we've been hearing the preacher appeal to his people, we have seen that he has a deep and unquestionable love for them. But it's a love that has driven him to be hard on them. Last week we saw this in all its fullness when he confronted them with a warning that would have shook their faith as much as it did ours. He challenged them to leave their dull-eared, immature comfort zone and embrace a faith that grew, that showed itself, a faith that stood out from the crowd so that they would not prove that their faith was fake, but they would prove that their faith was genuine, so that they wouldn't harden their hearts against Jesus, never to return to him. Well, at the end of last week's passage, the preacher moves on from speaking about the potential that exists to leave Jesus never to return, to focus on his hopes for his own people with regard to this warning. And if you just jump back a little bit and look at Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 9, we'll have a look at a little section that I didn't get to last week because of the magnitude of the earlier verses. Though we speak in this way, yet in your case, beloved, we feel sure of better things, things that belong to salvation. For God is not unjust so as to overlook your work and the love that you have shown for his name in serving the saints as you still do. And we desire each one of you to show the same earnestness and to have the full assurance of hope until the end, so that you may not be sluggish, but imitators of those who through faith and patience inherit the promises. Here the preacher shows that despite the toughness of his love for them in the previous verses, his love is truly genuine. And he trusts that his congregation that he loves is not going to fall victim to the hardness of heart that he warned against. He has seen their Christ-like love, he has seen their Christ-like service, and he believes that it is evidence of their genuine faith. And so in verse 12, he calls them on in this faith, calling them to imitate other saints who through their patience and faithfulness have made it to the end and seen the joy of their salvation. In this faith-expanding call, he will unpack the confidence that they can have in Jesus. And as he does, we're going to see three things that we need to know about faith. Faith is kind of like a weird concept for us. It's this word that we say a lot, but we don't ever really dig into what it means to have faith. And sometimes we can get some pretty wrong ideas about what faith is. And so this morning, we're going to see three things that I hope will crystallize what faith is for us and call all of us to have that faith in God and maybe call some of us to do that for the very first time. If the people were looking for an example of one of these kinds of people who, through patience and endurance, have made it to the end, then they could look no further than the example of Abraham, the example that the preacher will bring before them in verse 13. For when God made a promise to Abraham, since he had no one greater by whom to swear, he swore by himself, saying, "Surely I will bless you and multiply you." And thus Abraham, having patiently waited, obtained the promise. The preacher is referring to one of the most pivotal moments in the history of the Jewish people. This story that he is referring to takes place when Abraham has taken Isaac up the mountain of God to offer him as a sacrifice, called by God to offer his beloved son as a sacrifice. Abraham, by faith, goes up the mountain with his child, with the wood, with some fire, ready to offer a sacrifice. When God finally intervenes and calls Abraham back from sacrificing his son and provides a lamb for him caught in the bushes that would be offered in Isaac's place, God speaks to Abraham and says, this is from Genesis 22, 16, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this and not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you, and I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of the heaven and as the sand that is on the seashore. And your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you obeyed my voice." This story would have been rightfully at the very center of Jewish history, and the preacher is right to highlight the faithfulness of Abraham. But before he wants to focus on Abraham and his faith, he actually wants us to focus on God and his faithfulness. The preacher's main point is not so much that Abraham had faith, but what Abraham had faith in, who Abraham had faith in. The preacher's main point is that God was faithful to keep his promise. Swearing by himself that he would shower Abraham and his descendants with covenant blessings. Verse 16, "For people swear by something greater than themselves, and in all their disputes an oath is final for confirmation." We have a tendency to swear on things that we consider to be sacred or valuable to us. We say things like, "I swear on my grandmother's grave," sort of indicating that my respect and reverence that I had for my grandmother, I put that on the line to say that, I promise to keep my word, swearing on my grandmother's grave. "I swear on the sword of my father." Like, my father was a man of honor. He was a fighter of note. He is a man who is trustworthy. And so I swear on his reputation that I will keep my word. "I swear on my own soul." Shakespeare put this into his plays. It's like the deepest possible oath a person could make, that they would put their own eternal soul on the line, that their soul would be corrupt or bankrupt if they didn't keep their word. This is us reaching for something greater than ourselves to act as a guarantee of our oath. This is probably because part of us knows that on many levels we're not trustworthy on our own. That if we were to simply say, "You'll just have to take my word for it," we are dubious whether people would believe us or not. And so we search for something greater, something that is revered, that we might prove how passionate we are about whatever it is we're promising or whatever story it is that we're telling. We reach for something greater than ourselves as a guarantee of the oath that we are making. But when God comes to make a promise, When God looks to swear that he will keep his word to Abraham, he does not need to go looking for something greater than himself. If God is truly God, then surely there is nothing greater than him. He doesn't have a grandmother or a father to swear on, nor does he have any possession that he values more than himself. So God swears by himself to keep his word to Abraham. What this means is that God is actually laying it all on the line for this promise to Abraham. God is effectively saying, on the basis of my reputation as a promise keeper, I will keep this promise to you. In other words, if I break this promise, it destroys who I am in the eyes of the world. People will think of me as corrupt. People will think of me as shamed if I break my promise to you. Here's the deal. God puts his own life on the line as a guarantee of this promise. He will die before he breaks it. See, far too often, I think we think of faith in terms of how strongly we are holding on to God. We think of people who are strong in faith, and we kind of think of people whose grip on God must be incredibly strong. But in reality, the preacher is saying that even Abraham's great faith was not something born within himself. It was not as if Abraham had to summon up some deep internal belief in order to trust God. Abraham trusted God on the basis of something, the basis of God's own strength to keep his promise, the basis that God had offered himself as guarantee of his word. Abraham looked at God and saw everything that had been revealed to him about God, heard the basis of God's promise to him, and reasoned in his heart that his promise was worth trusting. Abraham's great faith, therefore, was not a matter of how much he trusted God, but a matter of how trustworthy God proved himself to be. Verse 15 tells us that this faith was rewarded. And thus Abraham, having patiently waited, obtained the promise. In this we actually have a beautiful definition of faith. Faith is patiently waiting for God to honor his word. Patiently waiting for God to honor his word. We think of faith as striving. We think of faith as us climbing up towards God. It's not the case at all. Faith is waiting, patiently waiting for God to come good on his promises. Faith is trusting that God will come good on his promises, even if it seems like he won't. This is the first thing we need to learn this morning about our faith. Faith is patiently waiting for God to honor his word, to come good on his promises. And I think this is liberating, because it means that saving faith does not hinge on the strength of your trusting, but on the trustworthiness of the one you are trusting. In calling people to faith, the preacher is not calling his people to look within themselves and find a stronger faith to believe, but to look upon the character of their God and find him trustworthy. You don't have to sort of summon strength within yourself to believe in God. God reveals himself as a faithful, trustworthy, promise keeper, even to the point of putting his reputation and his very life on the line, making himself the oath by which he swears. This is what God has done to call us to faith. He has proved himself to be trustworthy by putting himself on the line. See, because the problem with our oaths on our grandmothers, our fathers' swords, and our own souls is that hearing someone say this only carries as much weight as the oath maker's relationship to whatever they swear on. Maybe they didn't have a very good relationship with their grandmother at all. Maybe their grandmother, they never knew their grandmother, so her grave means nothing. Maybe she's not even dead and doesn't have a grave. Who knows? Maybe their father had a reputation of being a liar and a thief and a cheat. What sort of oath based on his sword carries any weight then? Maybe they don't even believe they have a soul. And so, I swear by my soul will be eternally condemned if I don't keep my word. If I don't think I've got a soul, that means nothing. Despite our search for something beyond ourselves to swear by, the reality is we usually fall dramatically short. It's normally lip service. It's normally not really the oath that we're making. But what of God? God has made a promise to Abraham on the basis of his own self, putting his trustworthy reputation on the line. Are we right to trust God on this basis? What guarantees are there for us that God is worth taking at his word? Well, look at verse 17. So when God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise the unchangeable character of his purpose, he guaranteed it with an oath, so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled for refuge might have strong encouragement to hold fast to the hope set before us. The preacher says that there are two things, two unchangeable things that guarantee God's self-swearing oath. The first is the unchangeable character of his purpose. In other words, God is not fickle. He doesn't change his mind at the drop of a hat. He doesn't backflip like politicians of our day. Once he sets his mind to something, he will keep persisting with it right to the very end. This means that God is a constant, while the shifting sands of popular opinion, of what is progressive, of what is relevant, will always be changing. God will always be the same. His character and his purposes never, ever change. When God says he will do something, he will do it. He will do it until the very end. The unchangeable character of God's purpose is a guarantee that his promise, sworn on himself, his unchangeable character, is worth trusting. The second is the unquestionable truth of his word. It is impossible for God to lie. If God was to tell one lie, he ceases to be God. God is the source of all truth. When he says something, it can be completely relied on. It will always be truth. We might not like what God says. It might make us feel uncomfortable. It might even make us feel guilty or feel condemned. But it will always be true. Our reaction to God's word doesn't determine whether it's true or not. In this world that we live in, so often it's my feelings that determine truth. Someone says something and I don't like it, so I just say, that's not true. We can claim something to be fake news just because we don't like it. That's the world we live in. Not so with God. We might not like the things that God says. We might love the things that God says. But that our feelings, our response to what God says doesn't determine whether it's true or not. God's word is true in and of itself. What this means is that when God makes a promise, it's not empty. It's not conditional on anything. It won't be explained away with political spin. I didn't really promise. The truth of God's word is unquestionable. His word is always true. It is impossible for him to lie. The upshot of these two evidences is that we who have fled for refuge might have a strong encouragement to hold fast to Jesus. In other words, when we meet a God who will never change, and when we listen to a God who will never lie, we are drawn to him, captivated by him, to the point where we thrust ourselves upon him. We who have fled for refuge. It's an interesting phrase to describe the church. I mean, the church is described in many ways: the bride of Christ, the household of God, the family of God, the brotherhood of God. I don't think we often call ourselves we who have fled for refuge. It's an interesting phrase. It almost makes us out to be a cowardly mob of people who are running to God for help. It seems to support the modern critiques of faith, which call it a crutch for the weak. But the faith actually suggests a fleeing to rather than a fleeing away. In other words, the church are the people who have sought refuge in God above all else. See, the reality is that the accusation that the religion or that faith is just a crutch for the weak is a little bit rich, because all humans are weak. All of us are weak. And we all flee to something for refuge. Some flee to money to make them feel safe. Some flee to education to give them significance. Some flee to a relationship so that they aren't left feeling lonely. Some flee to their health to shore up their future. As weak and broken people living in a turbulent and broken world, we're all refugees. We're all fleeing to something that we think can keep us safe. The church is just the people who've chosen Jesus as their refuge. Chosen Jesus over money. Chosen Jesus over education. Jesus over relationships. Jesus over health. Jesus over anything else that this world has to offer. This is the second thing we need to understand about our faith. Faith is taking refuge in the God who never changes and the God who never lies. Your bank balance will change. I guarantee you it will change. At some points it will be quite high and looking healthy, and at other points it might look red. It might look very low indeed. Your education will become redundant with every changing technology. It becomes redundant. There's a new bit of information you need to learn. You will constantly be on the treadmill of learning. People will betray you and use you. Relationships will crush and crumble. And your health, I guarantee you, one day your health will fail you. You might live a healthy, flourishing life right to the day you die, but you will die. It will come. Your health will fail you one day. But the God who never changes, and the God who never lies, remains long after everything else has faded. We are all fleeing to find refuge in something. We all feel the brokenness and the weakness of our lives in our humanity. We are all looking for something that can act as a crutch to prop us up. Christian faith is simply choosing Jesus as that refuge. Simply looking at everything that Jesus has to offer. Looking at the fact he never changes. Looking at the fact that he never lies. Looking at the fact that he always keeps his promises. And deciding that that is the only trustworthy place that we can find refuge. Faith isn't a strong climb up a mountain towards God. It's a fleeing from weakness to find help and refuge in our time of need, in the one place that will never change, in the one place that will never betray us or lie to us, in the arms of the Almighty, unchanging, always truthful God. So the preacher has shown the people that God trusts himself to be able to swear upon himself, and that God is worth taking refuge in because he is unquestionably constant and unquestionably true. But these are things that could have easily found a home in Judaism, especially when Abraham, the father of the Jewish nation, has been used as this example of faith. So in order to separate Christian faith from Jewish faith, the preacher does what he has been doing right throughout his sermon. he turns his attention to Jesus. Look at verse 19. We have this as a sure and steadfast anchor of the soul, a hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain where Jesus has gone as a forerunner on our behalf, having become a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Years ago, I spent a fair bit of time fishing with a mate who owned a boat. He loved his boat. He loved taking people out fishing. He was an incredibly passionate and enthusiastic fisherman to the point where when he was fishing, he sort of forgot about all common sense. And quite often, I think three times I was fishing with him, he took off with the anchor still down, snapped the anchor and had no anchor and had to go and buy another one. I don't know whether the guys at the boating shop got a good kick out of him turning up time and time again to buy anchors. But nonetheless, that's what he did. One time we were out and the plan was we're going to go out, we're going to stay out overnight, we'll go find a harbour and we'll camp out overnight in the boat. And then we'll fish all day, camp out overnight and fish again the next morning. That was the plan. And so we went out, we're fishing around, and at some point late in the afternoon, we're sort of like, oh, well, there's Moira Harbour over there. We can go in there and we'll be safe in there. And we looked across the bay and here's a storm coming. And we're like, that's okay, we'll just head into the bay. And so in the busyness of getting everything in, all the lines in, all the different bait secured and everything, my mate does his usual trick. Off he goes and there's the anchor still down and snap goes the anchor rope and we don't have an anchor. Now, other times that this had happened, we just putted the boat back to the boat ramp, put it on his car and he went and bought another anchor. But we wanted to stay out overnight. You know what? You can't go into a harbour without an anchor. You just can't. It's useless. You can't. Because you would just drift around in the harbour, smashing into all the other boats because they were all anchored. And we didn't have enough fuel or energy to stay awake all night using the engine to try and keep us in the one place. It's just not going to work. And so if we stayed out overnight in this harbour, we would crash into other boats. If we stayed out on the open water, we would be at the mercy of the storm. Anchors are pretty vital if you're going to go out on the water. And here the preacher says that anchors are vital in our life as well. The flow of this life is just as turbulent as a stormy ocean. But there is for the believer an anchor for the soul. A sure and steadfast anchor that can hold you firm through the raging storms and changing tides of life. But the thing about anchors are they need two things to be of any value. They need to be strong in themselves. They can't be rusty. They can't be weak. They can't be lightweight. They can't be prone to letting go. They need to be strong. The anchor can't break. The anchor rope can't break. They need to be strong within themselves. And secondly, they need to be anchored to something that won't move. They need to stay where you want to be. We wanted to be in the harbour. And so the anchor would have needed to stay in the seabed, in the harbour, so that that's where we would stay as well. Already the preacher has shown us that God is confident in his own capacity to keep his word. And he's unquestionable in character and word. But the big point of verses 19 to 20 is that Jesus is in fact the greatest expression of this rock-solid God. Jesus is the perfect anchor for your soul. This is because Jesus is the perfect expression of everything a good anchor needs to be. Jesus is strong within himself. Before Jesus, the Jewish nation had made a right mess of living out the blessings of the promises that God had made to them through Abraham, to the point where it seemed as though the promises might fail completely. But Jesus is the God who laid his life on the line to keep his promises. God had sworn by himself that he would keep his promises. God had put his own life on the line to say that he would keep his promises. And so even though it was our failure and our rebellion, God had promised to save his people independent of our obedience or disobedience. He'd sworn upon himself. And in Jesus, God paid that price, the price of himself, to secure his promises for us. Jesus is a strong anchor. Jesus is not going anywhere. Jesus is not going to let go or give way. He will go to death before he lets go of you. Jesus is strong within himself. And Jesus is anchored where we really long to be. Not only is Jesus strong within himself, but these verses tell us where he has planted that strength. A hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain where Jesus has gone as a forerunner on our behalf. This is speaking of the Holy of Holies, the very presence of God, the place where humanity and God met face to face. It is like Jesus has gone into the very presence of God, sat at his right hand in glory, and dug in for the long haul. And we who are united to him by faith have our place in that same glory secured because he has dug his feet in, because he has dug down deep and he is holding on forever. He will never move from that place at the right hand of his Father. Jesus is our forerunner into the glorious presence of God. It's like God cast Jesus out before us as an anchor that landed where he longed for us to be, right at his feet, right at the foot of his throne. That's where God has put Jesus, his anchor. And all who are united to him by faith will be held in that place by a strong and certain and sure anchor. And this is the third thing we need to know about faith. The goal of our faith has already been secured by Jesus. He waits in heaven for us like an anchor who will not move. And faith is simply trusting that by remaining in him, the tides, the storms, and the sweeping currents of this life will come and go, but we will never be taken from where we desperately long to be. Faith is trusting that God has planted Jesus at his feet, and so by being in Jesus, you will be at his feet as well. Perhaps you're here this morning and you've been thinking, I just don't know if I will ever have enough faith for God. I've been striving to be faithful, but to tell the truth, I feel more like a failure than ever before. Maybe I just don't have what it takes to follow Jesus. I want to appeal to you this morning to see that faith is not about striving and straining to be strong enough to follow Jesus. Faith actually starts with the complete opposite of striving and straining. Faith starts with recognizing your weakness, recognizing that you desperately need to take refuge in Jesus. And it's fueled by seeing that Jesus is the truly trustworthy one. All the pressure for our faith is actually on Jesus, not us. Do you realize that? Jesus had to prove that God keeps his promises. Jesus is the one that had to show that God is trustworthy. Jesus is the one who had to show that he is the strong anchor, that he is the safe refuge, that he is the best place that we can be. And he has shown it through his death, his resurrection, and his ascension to the right hand of the Father. Through this, Jesus has proved that God, when he lays his life down for his word, will lay his life down to keep his word. That Jesus is the sure and steadfast anchor for our soul. He is the only one who has gone into the presence of God and planted himself there, never to move or never to give way. Christian faith is not about striving to be worthy enough for heaven. It's not about climbing a mountain to get closer to God. is about clinging to Jesus, the sure and certain anchor for our souls, whose strength can hold us against raging storms and rushing tides. So I want to encourage you this morning, no matter where you are in your faith journey, that you can rest in Jesus. If you are united to Him by faith, if you have trusted Him, then that is all you need. You are bound to the anchor which is rooted at the foot of the throne of God in heaven. And you will never, ever be moved from there. That you have a safe refuge in Jesus. That you can flee the weakness and the brokenness of your life to something that actually won't change, that won't let you down, that won't lie to you, that won't betray you. You have a safe refuge and a strong anchor in Jesus. And so I would appeal to all of us this morning to trust Him. But maybe you have never trusted in this Jesus before. Maybe you have yet to place your faith in Him. Maybe you have thought Jesus to be so far beyond you that you could never trust Him enough. Can I encourage you that your faith only needs to be the size of a mustard seed? Because the faith, the object of your faith, is rooted in heaven at the foot of the throne, immovable, unchangeable. He will never change, He will never lie, and He has sworn upon His own self to keep His promises to you. And so your faith doesn't need to be big. It just needs to be in the only sure and certain anchor there ever will be. And so can I call on you to reach out to this Jesus this morning? Let's pray.